Isaac hugged awkwardly. "How are you feeling?" Isaac asked. "Everything tastes like pennies. Aside from that, I'm on a roller coaster that only goes up, kid," Gus answered. Isaac laughed. "How are the eyes?"
"Oh, excellent," he said. "I mean, they're not in my head is the only problem."
"Awesome, yeah," Gus said. "Not to one-up you or anything, but my body is made out of cancer."
"So I heard,"
Isaac said, trying not to let it get to him. He fumbled toward Gus's hand and found only his thigh.
"I'm taken," Gus said.
Isaac's mom brought over two dining room chairs, and Isaac and I sat down next to Gus. I took Gus's hand, stroking circles around the space between his thumb and forefinger. The adults headed down to the basement to commiserate or whatever, leaving the three of us alone in the living room. After a while, Augustus turned his head to us, the waking up slow.
"How's Monica?" he asked.
"Haven't heard from her once," Isaac said. "No cards, no emails. I got this machine that reads me my emails. It's awesome. I can change the voice's gender or accent or whatever."
"So, like, I can send you a porn story, and you can have an old German man read it to you?"
"Exactly," Isaac said. "Although Mom still has to help me with it, so maybe hold off on the German porno for a week or two."
"She hasn't even, like, texted you to ask how you're doing?" I asked.
This struck me as an unfathomable injustice.
"Total radio silence," Isaac said.
"Ridiculous," I said.
"I've stopped thinking about it. I don't have time to have a girlfriend. I have, like, a full-time job learning how to be blind."
Gus turned his head back away from us, staring out the window at the patio in his backyard. His eyes closed. Isaac asked how I was doing, and I said I was good, and he told me there was a new girl in support group with a really hot voice, and he needed me to go tell him if she was actually hot. Then out of nowhere, Augustus said, "You can't just not contact your former boyfriend after his eyes get cut out of his freaking head."
"Just one of," Isaac started.
"Hazel Grace, do you have $4? Asked Gus.
I said, "Yes?"
"Excellent. You'll find my leg under the coffee table," he said.
Gus pushed himself upright and scooted down to the edge of the couch. I handed him the prosthetic. He fastened it in slow motion. I helped him to stand and then offered my arm to Isaac, guiding him past furniture that suddenly seemed intrusive, realizing that, for the first time in years, I was the healthiest person in the room. I drove. Augustus rode shotgun. Isaac sat in the back. We stopped at a grocery store where, per Augustus's instruction, I bought a dozen eggs while he and Isaac waited in the car. And then Isaac guided us by his memory to Monica's house, an aggressively sterile, two-story house near the JCC. Monica's bright green 1990s Pontiac Firebird sat fat-wheeled in the driveway.
"Is it there?"
Isaac asked when he felt me coming to a stop.
"Oh, it's there," Augustus said. "You know what it looks like, Isaac? It looks like all the hopes we were foolish to hope."
"So she's inside?" Gus turned his head around slowly to look at Isaac.
"Who cares where she is? This is not about her. This is about you."
Gus gripped the egg carton in his lap, then opened the door and pulled his legs out onto the street. He opened the door for Isaac, and I watched through the mirror as Gus helped Isaac out of the car, the two of them leaning on each other at the shoulder, then tapering away like praying hands that don't quite meet at the palms. I rolled down the windows and watched from the car, because vandalism made me nervous. They took a few steps toward the car, then Gus flipped open the egg carton and handed Isaac an egg. Isaac tossed it, missing the car by a solid 40 feet.
"A little to the left," Gus said.
"My throw was a little to the left, or I need to aim a little to the left?"
"Aim left."
Isaac swiveled his shoulders.
"Lefter," Gus said.
Isaac swiveled again.
"Yes. Excellent. And throw hard."
Gus handed him another egg, and Isaac hurled it, the egg arcing over the car and smashing against the slow-sloping roof of the house.
"Bullseye," Gus said.
"Really?"
Isaac asked excitedly. "No, you threw it like 20 feet over the car. Just throw hard, but keep it low, and a little right of where you were last time.
Isaac reached over and found an egg himself from the carton Gus cradled. He tossed it, hitting a taillight.
Yes, Gus said. Yes, taillight!
Isaac reached for another egg, missed wide right, then another, missing low, then another, hitting the back windshield. He then nailed 3 in a row against the trunk.
Hazel Grace, Gus shouted back to me, take a picture of this so Isaac can see it when they invent robot eyes.
I pulled myself up so I was sitting in the rolled-down window, my elbows on the roof of the car, and snapped a picture with my phone. Augustus, an unlit cigarette in his mouth, his smile deliciously crooked, holds the mostly empty pink egg carton above his head. His other hand is draped around Isaac's shoulder, whose sunglasses are turned not quite toward the camera. Behind them, egg yolks drip down the windshield and bumper of the green Firebird, and behind that, a door is opening.
What? Asked the middle-aged woman a moment after I'd snapped the picture. In God's name?
And then she stopped talking.
Ma'am, Augustus said, nodding toward her, your daughter's car has just been deservedly egged by a blind man. Please close the door and go back inside, or we'll be forced to call the police.
After wavering for a moment, Monica's mom closed the door and disappeared. Isaac threw the last 3 eggs in quick succession, and Gus then guided him back toward the car.
See, Isaac, if you just take, we're coming to the curb now, the feeling of legitimacy away from them, if you turn it around so they feel like they are committing a crime by watching, a few more steps, their cars get egged, they'll be confused and scared and worried, and they'll just return to their, you'll find the door handle directly in front of you, quietly desperate lives.
Gus hurried around the front of the car and installed himself in the shotgun seat. The door is closed, and I roared off, driving for several hundred feet before I realized I was headed down a dead-end street. I circled the cul-de-sac and raced back past Monica's house. I never took another picture of him. Chapter 15. A few days later, at Gus's house, his parents and my parents and Gus and me all squeezed around the dining room table, eating stuffed peppers on a tablecloth that had, according to Gus's dad, last seen use in the previous century. My dad,
Emily, this risotto.
My mom, it's just delicious. Gus's mom, oh, thanks. I'd be happy to give you the recipe. Gus, swallowing a bite,
you know, the primary taste I'm getting is not orange.
Me, good observation, Gus. This food, while delicious, does not taste like orange.
My mom,
Hazel.
Gus, it tastes like...
Me, food.
Gus, yes, precisely. It tastes like food, excellently prepared, but it does not taste... How do I put this delicately?
Me, it does not taste like God himself cooked heaven into a series of 5 dishes which were then served to you, accompanied by several luminous balls of fermented, bubbly plasma, while actual and literal flower petals floated down all around your canal-side dinner table.
Gus, nicely phrased.
Gus's father,
our children are weird.
My dad,
nicely phrased.
A week after our dinner, Gus ended up in the ER with chest pain, and they admitted him overnight, so I drove over to Memorial the next morning and visited him on the 4th floor. I hadn't been to Memorial since visiting Isaac. It didn't have any of the cloyingly bright primary color painted walls or the framed paintings of dogs driving cars that one found at Children's, but the absolute sterility of the place made me nostalgic for the happy kid bullshit at Children's. Memorial was so functional. It was a storage facility, a crematorium. When the elevator doors opened on the 4th floor, I saw Gus's mom pacing in the waiting room, talking on a cell phone. She hung up quickly, then hugged me and offered to take my cart. I'm okay, I said. How's Gus?
He had a tough night, Hazel, she said. His heart is working too hard. He needs to scale back on activity. Wheelchairs from here on out. They're putting him on some new medicine that should be better for the pain. His sisters just drove in.
Okay, I said. Can I see him?
She put her arm around me and squeezed my shoulder. It felt weird.
You know we love you, Hazel. But right now we just need to be a family. Gus agrees with that, okay?
Okay, I said.
I'll tell him you visited.
Okay, I said. I'm just gonna read here for a while, I think.
She went down the hall, back to where he was. I understood, but I still missed him. Still thought maybe I was missing my last chance to see him, to say goodbye or whatever. The waiting room was all brown carpet and brown overstuffed cloth chairs. I sat in a love seat for a while, my oxygen cart tucked by my feet. I'd worn my Chuck Taylors and my Ceci n'est pas un peep shirt, the exact outfit I'd been wearing 2 weeks before on the late afternoon of the Venn diagram, and he wouldn't see it. I started scrolling through the pictures on my phone, a backward flip book of the last few months, beginning with him and Isaac outside of Monica's house, and ending with the first picture I'd taken of him, on the drive to Funky Bones. It seemed like forever ago. Like we'd had this brief but still infinite forever. Some infinities are bigger than other infinities. 2 weeks later, I wheeled Gus across the art park toward Funky Bones with one entire bottle of very expensive champagne and my oxygen tank in his lap. The champagne had been donated by one of Gus's doctors, Gus being the kind of person who inspires doctors to give their best bottles of champagne to children. We sat, Gus in his chair and me on the damp grass, as near to Funky Bones as we could get him in the chair. I pointed at the little kids goading each other to jump from ribcage to shoulder, and Gus answered just loud enough for me to hear over the din. Last time, I imagined myself as the kid. This time, the skeleton. We drank from paper Winnie the Pooh cups. Chapter 16. A Typical Day with Late Stage Gus. I went over to his house about noon, after he had eaten and puked up breakfast. He met me at the door in his wheelchair, no longer the muscular, gorgeous boy who stared at me at support group, but still half-smiling, still smoking his unlit cigarette, his blue eyes bright and alive. We ate lunch with his parents at the dining room table, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and last night's asparagus. Gus didn't eat. I asked how he was feeling.
Grand, he said. And you?
Good. What did you do last night?
I slept quite a lot.
I want to write you a sequel, Hazel Grace, but I'm just so damn tired all the time.
You can just tell it to me, I said.
Well, I stand by my pre-Van Houten analysis of the Dutch tulip man. Not a con man, but not as rich as he was letting on.
And what about Anna's mom?
Haven't settled on an opinion there. Patience, grasshopper.
Augustus smiled. His parents were quiet, watching him, never looking away, like they just wanted to enjoy the Gus Waters show while it was still in town.
Sometimes I dream that I'm writing a memoir. A memoir would be just the thing to keep me in the hearts and memories of my adoring public.
Why do you need an adoring public when you've got me? I asked.
Hazel Grace, when you're as charming and physically attractive as myself, it's easy enough to win over people you meet. But getting strangers to love you, now, that's the trick.
I rolled my eyes. After lunch, we went outside to the backyard. He was still well enough to push his own wheelchair, pulling miniature wheelies to get the front wheels over the bump in the doorway. Still athletic, in spite of it all. Blessed with balance and quick reflexes that even the abundant narcotics could not fully mask. His parents stayed inside, but when I glanced back into the dining room, they were always watching us. We sat out there in silence for a minute, and then Gus said, "I wish we had that swing set sometimes."
"The one from my backyard?"
"Yeah. My nostalgia is so extreme that I am capable of missing a swing my butt never actually touched."
"Nostalgia is a side effect of cancer," I told him.
"Nah, Nostalgia is a side effect of dying, he answered. Above us, the wind blew and the branching shadows rearranged themselves on our skin. Gus squeezed my hand. It is a good life, Hazel Grace. We went inside when he needed meds, which were pressed into him along with liquid nutrition through his G-tube, a bit of plastic that disappeared into his belly. He was quiet for a while, zoned out. His mom wanted him to take a nap, but he kept shaking his head no when she suggested it, so we just let him sit there half asleep in the chair for a while. His parents watched an old video of Gus with his sisters. They were probably my age, and Gus was about 5. They were playing basketball in the driveway of a different house, and even though Gus was tiny, he could dribble like he'd been born doing it, running circles around his sisters as they laughed. It was the first time I'd even seen him play basketball. He was good, I said.
Should have seen him in high school, his dad said. Started varsity as a freshman.
Gus mumbled,
Can I go downstairs?
His mom and dad wheeled the chair downstairs with Gus still in it, bouncing down crazily in a way that would have been dangerous if danger retained its relevance, and then they left us alone. He got into bed and we lay there together under the covers, me on my side and Gus on his back, my head on his bony shoulder, his heat radiating through his polo shirt and into my skin, my feet tangled with his real foot, my hand on his cheek. When I got his face nose-touchingly close so that I could only see his eyes, I couldn't tell he was sick. We kissed for a while and then lay together listening to the Hectic Glow's eponymous album, and eventually we fell asleep like that, a quantum entanglement of tubes and bodies. We woke up later and arranged an armada of pillows so that we could sit comfortably against the edge of the bed and played Counterinsurgents 2, The Price of Dawn. I sucked at it, of course, but my sucking was useful to him. It made it easier for him to die beautifully, to jump in front of a sniper's bullet and sacrifice himself for me, or else to kill a sentry who was just about to shoot me. How he reveled in saving me. He shouted, You will not kill my girlfriend today, international terrorist of ambiguous nationality. It crossed my mind to fake a choking incident or something so that he might give me the Heimlich. Maybe then he could rid himself of this fear that his life had been lived and lost for no greater good. But then I imagined him being physically unable to Heimlich, and me having to reveal that it was all a ruse, and the ensuing mutual humiliation. It's hard as hell to hold on to your dignity when the risen sun is too bright in your losing eyes. And that's what I was thinking about as we hunted for bad guys through the ruins of a city that didn't exist. Finally, his dad came down and dragged Gus back upstairs, and in the entryway, beneath an encouragement telling me that friends are forever, I knelt to kiss him goodnight. I went home and ate dinner with my parents, leaving Gus to eat and puke up his own dinner. After some TV, I went to sleep. I woke up. Around noon, I went over there again. Chapter 17. One morning, a month after returning home from Amsterdam, I drove over to his house. His parents told me he was still sleeping downstairs, so I knocked loudly on the basement door before entering, then asked, Gus? I found him mumbling in a language of his own creation. He'd pissed the bed. It was awful. I couldn't even look, really. I just shouted for his parents, and they came down, and I went upstairs while they cleaned him up. When I came back down, he was slowly waking up out of the narcotics to the excruciating day. I arranged his pillows so we could play Counterinsurgents on the bare sheetless mattress, but he was so tired and out of it that he sucked almost as bad as I did, and we couldn't go 5 minutes without both getting dead. Not fancy heroic deaths either. Just careless ones. I didn't really say anything to him. I almost wanted him to forget I was there, I guess. And I was hoping he didn't remember that I'd found the boy I love deranged in a wide pool of his own piss. I kept kind of hoping that he'd look over at me and say, Oh, Hazel Grace, how'd you get here? But unfortunately, he remembered. With each passing minute, I'm developing a deeper appreciation of the word mortified, he said finally.
I've pissed the bed, Gus, believe me. It's no big deal.
You used, he said, and then took a sharp breath, to call me Augustus. You know, he said after a while, it's kids stuff, but I always thought my obituary would be in all the newspapers, that I'd have a story worth telling. I always had this secret suspicion that I was special.
You are, I said.
You know what I mean, though, he said. I did know what he meant. I just didn't agree.
I don't care if the New York Times writes an obituary for me. I just want you to write one, I told him. You say you're not special because the world doesn't know about you, but that's an insult to me. I know about you.
I don't think I'm gonna make it to write your obituary, he said, instead of apologizing.
I was so frustrated with him. I just want to be enough for you, but I never can be. This can never be enough for you, but this is all you get. You get me and your family and this world. This is your life. I'm sorry if it sucks, but you're not going to be the first man on Mars, and you're not going to be an NBA star, and you're not going to hunt Nazis. I mean, look at yourself, Gus.
He didn't respond.
I don't mean...
I started. Oh, you meant it, he interrupted. I started to apologize, and he said, no, I'm sorry. You're right. Let's just play.
So we just played.
Chapter 18. I woke up to my phone singing a song by The Hectic Glow, Gus's favorite. That meant he was calling, or someone was calling from his phone. I glanced at the alarm clock. 2:35 a.m. He's gone, I thought as everything inside of me collapsed into a singularity. I could barely creak out a, hello? I waited for the sound of a parent's annihilated voice.
Hazel Grace,
Augustus said weakly.
Oh, thank God it's you. Hi. Hi, I love you.
Hazel Grace, I'm at the gas station. Something's wrong. You gotta help me.
What? Where are you?
The speedway at 86th and Ditch. I did something wrong with the G-tube and I can't figure it out and...
I'm calling 911, I said.
No, 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 no. They'll take me to a hospital. Hazel, listen to me. Do not call 911 or my parents. I will never forgive you. Don't. Please just come. Please just come and fix my goddamn G-tube. I'm just... God, this is the stupidest thing. I don't want my parents to know I'm gone. Please. I have the medicine with me. I just can't get it in. Please.
He was crying. I'd never heard him sob like this except from outside his house before Amsterdam. Okay, I said. I'm leaving now.
I took the BiPAP off and connected myself to an oxygen tank, lifted the tank into my cart, and put on sneakers to go with my pink cotton pajama pants and a Butler basketball t-shirt which had originally been Gus's. I grabbed the keys from the kitchen drawer where Mom kept them and wrote a note in case they woke up while I was gone. Went to check on Gus. It's important. Sorry. Love, H. As I drove the couple miles to the gas station, I woke up enough to wonder why Gus had left the house in the middle of the night. Maybe he'd been hallucinating, or his martyrdom fantasies had gotten the better of him. I sped up Ditch Road past flashing yellow lights, going too fast partly to reach him and partly in the hopes a cop would pull me over and give me an excuse to tell someone that my dying boyfriend was stuck outside of a gas station with a malfunctioning G-tube. But no cop showed up to make my decision for me. There were only two cars in the lot. I pulled up next to his. I opened the door. The interior lights came on. Augustus sat in the driver's seat, covered in his own vomit, his hands pressed to his belly where the G-tube went in.
Hi,
he mumbled.
Oh, God, Augustus, we have to get you to a hospital.
Please just look at it.
I gagged from the smell but bent forward to inspect the place above his belly button where they'd surgically installed the tube.
The skin of his abdomen was warm and bright red.
Gus, I think something's infected. I can't fix this. Why are you here? Why aren't you home?
He puked, without even the energy to turn his mouth away from his lap.
Oh, sweetie,
I said.
I wanted to buy a pack of cigarettes, he mumbled. I lost my pack. Or they took it away from me, I don't know. They said they'd get me another one, but I wanted to do it myself. Do one little thing myself.
He was staring straight ahead. Quietly, I pulled out my phone and glanced down to dial 911.
I'm sorry, I told him.
911, what is your emergency?
Hi, I'm at the Speedway at 86th and Ditch, and I need an ambulance. The great love of my life has a malfunctioning G-tube.
He looked up at me. It was horrible. I could hardly look at him. The Augustus Waters of the crooked smiles and unsmoked cigarettes was gone, replaced by this desperate, humiliated creature sitting there beneath me.
This is it.
I can't even not smoke anymore. Gus, I love you.
Where is my chance to be somebody's Peter Van Houten?
He hit the steering wheel weakly, the car honking as he cried. He leaned his head back, looking up.
I hate myself, I hate myself, I hate this, I hate it. I disgust myself, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. Just let me fucking die.
According to the conventions of the genre, Augustus Waters kept his sense of humor till the end, did not for a moment waver in his courage, and his spirit soared like an indomitable eagle until the world itself could not contain his joyous soul. But this was the truth. A pitiful boy who desperately wanted not to be pitiful, screaming and crying, poisoned by an infected G-tube that kept him alive, but not alive enough. I wiped his chin and grabbed his face in my hands and knelt down close to him so that I could see his eyes, which still lived.
I'm sorry. I wish it was like that movie, with the Persians and the Spartans.
Me too, he said.
But it isn't, I said.
I know,
he said.
There are no bad guys.
Yeah.
Even cancer isn't a bad guy, really. Cancer just wants to be alive.
Yeah.
You're okay, I told him.
I could hear the sirens.
Okay,
he said. He was losing consciousness.
Gus, you have to promise not to try this again. I'll get you cigarettes, okay?
He looked at me. His eyes swam in their sockets.
You have to promise.
He nodded a little and then his eyes closed, his head swiveling on his neck.
Gus, I said, stay with me.
Read me something,
he said as the goddamned ambulance roared right past us. So while I waited for them to turn around and find us, I recited the only poem I could bring to mind, The Red Wheelbarrow by William Carlos Williams. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow, glazed with rainwater, beside the white chickens. Williams was a doctor. It seemed to me like a doctor's poem. The poem was over, but the ambulance was still driving away from us, so I kept writing it.
And so much depends, I told Augustus, upon a blue sky cut open by the branches of the trees above. So much depends upon the transparent G-tube erupting from the gut of the blue-lipped boy. So much depends upon this observer of the universe.
Half-conscious, he glanced over at me and mumbled,
"And you say you don't write poetry."
Chapter 19. He came home from the hospital a few days later, finally and irrevocably robbed of his ambitions. It took more medication to remove him from the pain. He moved upstairs permanently, into a hospital bed near the living room window.
These were days of pajamas and beard scruff, of mumblings and requests and him endlessly thanking everyone for all they were doing on his behalf. One afternoon, he pointed vaguely toward a laundry basket in the corner of the room and asked me,
"What's that?"
"That laundry basket?"
"No, next to it."
"I don't see anything next to it."
"It's my last shred of dignity. It's very small."
The next day, I let myself in. They didn't like me to ring the doorbell anymore because it might wake him up. His sisters were there with their banker husbands and three kids, all boys, who ran up to me and chanted, "Who are you? Who are you? Who are you?" running circles around the entryway like lung capacity was a renewable resource. I'd met the sisters before, but never the kids or their dads. "I'm Hazel," I said.
"Gus has a girlfriend,"
one of the kids said.
"I am aware that Gus has a girlfriend," I said.
"She's got boobies,"
another said.
"Is that so?"
"Why do you have that?"
the first one asked, pointing at my oxygen cart.
"It helps me breathe," I said. "Is Gus awake?"
"No, he's sleeping."
"He's dying," said another. "He's dying," the third one confirmed, suddenly serious. It was quiet for a moment, and I wondered what I was supposed to say, but then one of them kicked another and they were off to the races again, falling all over each other in a scrum that migrated toward the kitchen. I made my way to Gus's parents in the living room and met his brothers-in-law, Chris and Dave. I hadn't gotten to know his half-sisters, really, but they both hugged me anyway. Julie was sitting on the edge of the bed, talking to a sleeping Gus in precisely the same voice that one would use to tell an infant he was adorable, saying,
"Oh, Gussie, Gussie, our little Gussie, Gussie."
Our Gussie? Had they acquired him? "What's up, Augustus?" I said, trying to model appropriate behavior.
"Our beautiful Gussie,"
Martha said, leaning in toward him. I began to wonder if he was actually asleep or if he'd just laid a heavy finger on the pain pump to avoid the attack of the well-meaning sisters. He woke up after a while, and the first thing he said was, "Hazel," which I have to admit made me kind of happy, like maybe I was part of his family, too.
"Outside," he said quietly. "Can we go?"
We went, his mom pushing the wheelchair, sisters and brothers-in-law and dad and nephews and me trailing. It was a cloudy day, still and hot as summer settled in. He wore a long-sleeve navy T-shirt and fleece sweatpants. He was cold all the time for some reason. He wanted some water, so his dad went and got some for him. Martha tried to engage Gus in conversation, kneeling down next to him and saying,
"You've always had such beautiful eyes."
He nodded a little. One of the husbands put an arm on Gus's shoulder and said,
"How's that fresh air feel?"
Gus shrugged.
"Do you want mitts?"
his mom asked, joining the circle kneeling around him. I took a step back, watching as the nephews tore through a flower bed on their way to the little patch of grass in Gus's backyard. They immediately commenced to play a game that involved throwing one another to the ground.
"Kids!"
Julie shouted vaguely.
"I can only hope," Julie said, turning back to Gus, "they grow into the kind of thoughtful, intelligent young men you've become."
I resisted the urge to audibly gag.
"He's not that smart," I said to Julie. "She's right. It's just that most really good-looking people are stupid, so I exceed expectations."
"Right. It's primarily his hotness," I said.
"It can be sort of blinding," he said.
"It actually did blind our friend Isaac," I said.
"Terrible tragedy, that. But can I help my own deadly beauty?"
"You cannot."
"It is my burden, this beautiful face.
Not to mention your body."
"Seriously, don't even get me started on my hot bod. You don't want to see me naked, Dave. Seeing me naked actually took Hazel Grace's breath away,"
he said, nodding toward the oxygen tank.
"Okay, enough," Gus's dad said. And then out of nowhere,
His dad put an arm around me and kissed the side of my head and whispered, "I thank God for you every day, kid." Anyway, that was the last good day I had with Gus until the last good day. Chapter 20. One of the less bullshitty conventions of the cancer kid genre is the last good day convention, wherein the victim of cancer finds herself with some unexpected hours when it seems like the inexorable decline has suddenly plateaued, when the pain is for a moment bearable. The problem, of course, is that there's no way of knowing that your last good day is your last good day. At the time, it is just another good day. I'd taken a day off from visiting Augustus because I was feeling a bit unwell myself. Nothing specific, just tired. It had been a lazy day, and when Augustus called just after 5 p.m., I was already attached to the BiPAP, which we'd dragged out to the living room so I could watch TV with Mom and Dad. "Hi, Augustus," I said. He answered in the voice I'd fallen for. "Good evening, Hazel Grace. Do you suppose you could find your way to the literal heart of Jesus around 8 p.m.? Yes? Excellent. Also, if it's not too much trouble, please prepare a eulogy." I said. "I love you," he said. "And I you," I answered. Then the phone clicked off. I said. "I have to go to support group at 8 tonight. Emergency session." My mom muted the TV. "Is everything okay?" I looked at her for a second, my eyebrows raised. "I assume that's a rhetorical question." "But why would there?" "Because Gus needs me. For some reason, it's fine. I can drive." I fiddled with the BiPAP so Mom would help me take it off, but she didn't. "Hazel," she said, "your dad and I feel like we hardly even see you anymore."
"Particularly those of us who work all week," Dad said.
"He needs me," I said, finally unfastening the BiPAP myself.
"We need you too, kiddo," my dad said.
He took hold of my wrist like I was a 2-year-old about to dart out into the street and gripped it. "Well, get a terminal disease, Dad, and then I'll stay home more."
"Hazel," my mom said.
"You are the one who didn't want me to be a homebody," I said to her. Dad was still clutching my arm. "And now you want him to go ahead and die, so I'll be back here chained to this place, letting you take care of me like I always used to? But I don't need it, Mom. I don't need you like I used to. You're the one who needs to get a life."
"Hazel," Dad said, squeezing harder, "apologize to your mother."
I was tugging at my arm, but he wouldn't let go, and I couldn't get my cannula on with only one hand. It was infuriating. All I wanted was an old-fashioned teenager walkout, wherein I stomp out of the room and slam the door to my bedroom and turn up the hectic glow and furiously write a eulogy. But I couldn't because I couldn't freaking breathe. "The cannula," I whined. "I need it." My dad immediately let go and rushed to connect me to the oxygen. I could see the guilt in his eyes, but he was still angry.
"Hazel, apologize to your mother."
"Fine. I'm sorry. Just please let me do this." They didn't say anything. Mom just sat there with her arms folded, not even looking at me. After a while, I got up and went to my room to write about Augustus. Both Mom and Dad tried a few times to knock on the door or whatever, but I just told them I was doing something important. It took me forever to figure out what I wanted to say, and even then I wasn't very happy with it. Before I'd technically finished, I noticed it was 7:40, which meant that I would be late even if I didn't change. So in the end, I wore baby blue cotton pajama pants, flip-flops, and Gus's butler shirt. I walked out of the room and tried to go right past them, but my dad said, "You can't leave the house without permission." "Oh, my God, Dad! He wanted me to write him a eulogy, okay? I'll be home every freaking night, starting any day now, okay?" That finally shut them up.
It took the entire drive to calm down about my parents. I pulled up around the back of the church and parked in the semicircular driveway behind Augustus's car. The back door to the church was held open by a fist-sized rock. Inside, I contemplated taking the stairs but decided to wait for the ancient creaking elevator. When the elevator doors unscrolled, I was in the support group room, the chairs arranged in the same circle. But now I saw only Gus in a wheelchair, ghoulishly thin. He was facing me from the center of the circle. He had been waiting for the elevator doors to open.
"Hazel Grace," he said, "you look ravishing."
"I know, right?"
I heard a shuffling in the dark corner of the room. Isaac stood behind a little wooden lectern, clinging to it.
"You want to sit?"
I asked him. "No, I'm about to eulogize. You're late."
What?
Gus gestured for me to sit. I pulled a chair into the center of the circle with him as he spun the chair to face Isaac.
"I want to attend my funeral," Gus said. "By the way, will you speak at my funeral?"
Of course, yeah, I said, letting my head fall onto his shoulder.
I reached across his back and hugged both him and the wheelchair. He winced. I let go.
"Awesome," he said. "I'm hopeful I'll get to attend as a ghost, but just to make sure, I thought I'd, well, not to put you on the spot, but I just this afternoon thought I could arrange a pre-funeral, and I figured since I'm in reasonably good spirits, there's no time like the present."
"How did you even get in here?" I asked him.
"Would you believe they leave the door open all night?" Gus asked.
No, I said.
"As well you shouldn't," Gus smiled. "Anyway, I know it's a bit self-aggrandizing."
"Hey, you're stealing my eulogy," Isaac said. "My first bit is about how you were a self-aggrandizing bastard."
I laughed. "Okay, okay," Gus said. "At your leisure."
Isaac cleared his throat.
"Augustus Waters was a self-aggrandizing bastard. But we forgive him. We forgive him not because he had a heart as figuratively good as his literal one sucked, or because he knew more about how to hold a cigarette than any non-smoker in history, or because he got 18 years when he should have gotten more."
17, Gus corrected.
"I'm assuming you've got some time, you interrupting bastard."
"I'm telling you," Isaac continued.
"Augustus Waters talked so much that he'd interrupt you at his own funeral. And he was pretentious. Sweet Jesus Christ, that kid never took a piss without pondering the abundant metaphorical resonances of human waste production. And he was vain. I do not believe I have ever met a more physically attractive person who was more acutely aware of his own physical attractiveness. But I will say this. When the scientists of the future show up at my house with robot eyes and they tell me to try them on, I will tell the scientists to screw off, because I do not want to see a world without him."
I was kind of crying by then.
"And then, having made my rhetorical point, I will put my robot eyes on, because, I mean, with robot eyes you can probably see through girls' shirts and stuff. Augustus, my friend, Godspeed."
Augustus nodded for a while, his lips pursed, and then gave Isaac a thumbs up. After he'd recovered his composure, he added,
"I would cut the bit about seeing through girls' shirts."
Isaac was still clinging to the lectern. He started to cry. He pressed his forehead down to the podium, and I watched his shoulders shake, and then finally he said,
"God damn it, Augustus. Editing your own eulogy."
"Don't swear in the literal heart of Jesus," Gus said.
"God damn it,"
Isaac said again. He raised his head and swallowed.
"Hazel, can I get a hand here?"
I'd forgotten he couldn't make his own way back to the circle. I got up, placed his hand on my arm, and walked him slowly back to the chair next to Gus where I'd been sitting. Then I walked up to the podium and unfolded the piece of paper on which I'd printed my eulogy. "My name is Hazel. Augustus Waters was the great star-crossed love of my life. Ours was an epic love story, and I won't be able to get more than a sentence into it without disappearing into a puddle of tears. Gus knew. Gus knows. I will not tell you our love story because, like all real love stories, it will die with us, as it should. I'd hoped that he'd be eulogizing me because there's no one I'd rather have. I started crying.
Okay. How not to cry? How am I? Okay. Okay.
I took a few breaths and went back to the page.
I can't talk about our love story,
so I will talk about math. I am not a mathematician, but I know this. There are infinite numbers between 0 and 1. There's 0.1 and 0.12 and 0.112 and an infinite collection of others. Of course, there is a bigger infinite set of numbers between 0 and 2, or between 0 and 1,000,000.
Some infinities are bigger than other infinities.
A writer we used to like taught us that. There are days, many of them, when I resent the size of my unbounded set.
I want more numbers than I'm likely to get, and God, I want more numbers for Augustus Waters than he got. But Gus, my love, I cannot tell you how thankful I am for our little infinity. I wouldn't trade it for the world. You gave me a forever within the numbered days, and I'm grateful.
Chapter 21. Augustus Waters died 8 days after his pre-funeral, at Memorial, in the ICU, when the cancer, which was made of him, finally stopped his heart, which was also made of him. He was with his mom and dad and sisters. His mom called me at 3:30 in the morning. I'd known, of course, that he was going. I'd talked to his dad before going to bed, and he told me it could be tonight. But still, when I grabbed the phone from the bedside table and saw Gus's mom on the caller ID, everything inside of me collapsed. She was just crying on the other end of the line, and she told me she was sorry. And I said I was sorry, too. And she told me that he was unconscious for a couple hours before he died. My parents came in then, looking expectant, and I just nodded, and they fell into each other, feeling, I'm sure, the harmonic terror that would in time come for them directly. I called Isaac, who cursed life and the universe and God himself, and who said, "Where are the goddamn trophies to break when you need them?" And then I realized there was no one else to call, which was the saddest thing. The only person I really wanted to talk to about Augustus Waters' death was Augustus Waters. My parents stayed in my room forever until it was morning, and finally Dad said, "Do you want to be alone?" And I nodded, and Mom said, "We'll be right outside the door." Me thinking, I don't doubt it. It was unbearable. The whole thing. Every second worse than the last. I just kept thinking about calling him, wondering what would happen, if anyone would answer. In the last weeks, we'd been reduced to spending our time together in recollection, but that was not nothing. The pleasure of remembering had been taken from me because there was no longer anyone to remember with. It felt like losing your co-rememberer meant losing the memory itself. As if the things we'd done were less real and important than they had been hours before. When you go into the ER, one of the first things they ask you to do is to rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, and from there they decide which drugs to use and how quickly to use them. I'd been asked this question hundreds of times over the years, and I remember once early on when I couldn't get my breath, and it felt like my chest was on fire, flames licking the inside of my ribs, fighting for a way to burn out of my body, my parents took me to the ER. A nurse asked me about the pain, and I couldn't even speak, so I held up 9 fingers. Later, after they'd given me something, The nurse came in and she was kind of stroking my hand while she took my blood pressure and she said, "You know how I know you're a fighter? You called a 10 a 9. But that wasn't quite right. I called it a 9 because I was saving my 10. And here it was, the great and terrible 10, slamming me again and again as I lay still and alone in my bed staring at the ceiling, the waves tossing me against the rocks, then pulling me back out to sea so they could launch me again into the jagged face of the cliff, leaving me floating face up on the water, undrowned. Finally, I did call him. His phone rang 5 times and then went to voicemail.
"You've reached the voicemail of Augustus Waters," he said,
the clarion voice I'd fallen for.
"Leave a message."
It beeped. The dead air on the line was so eerie. I just wanted to go back to that secret post-terrestrial third space with him that we visited when we talked on the phone. I waited for that feeling, but it never came. The dead air on the line was no comfort, and finally I hung up. I got my laptop out from under the bed and fired it up and went onto his wall page, where already the condolences were flooding in. The most recent one said, "I love you, bro. See you on the other side." Written by someone I'd never heard of. In fact, almost all of the wall posts, which arrived nearly as fast as I could read them, were written by people I'd never met and whom he'd never spoken about, people who were extolling his various virtues now that he was dead, even though I knew for a fact they hadn't seen him in months and had made no effort to visit him. I wondered if my wall would look like this if I died, or if I'd been out of school and life long enough to escape widespread memorialization. I kept reading. "I miss you already, bro. I love you, Augustus. God bless you and keep you. You'll live forever in our hearts, big man." That particularly galled me, because it implied the immortality of those left behind. "You will live forever in my memory, because I will live forever. I am your God now, dead boy. I own you." Thinking you won't die is yet another side effect of dying. "You were always such a great friend. I'm sorry I didn't see more of you after you left school, bro. I bet you're already playing ball in heaven." I imagined the Augustus Waters analysis of that comment. If I am playing basketball in heaven, does that imply a physical location of a heaven containing physical basketballs? Who makes the basketballs in question? Are there less fortunate souls in heaven who work in a celestial basketball factory so that I can play? Or did an omnipotent God create the basketballs out of the vacuum of space? Is this heaven in some kind of unobservable universe where the laws of physics don't apply? And if so, why in the hell would I be playing basketball when I could be flying or reading or looking at beautiful people or something else I actually enjoy? It's almost as if the way you imagine my dead self says more about you than it says about either the person I was or the whatever I am now. His parents called around noon to say the funeral would be in 5 days, on Saturday. I pictured a church packed with people who thought he liked basketball, and I wanted to puke, but I knew I had to go, since I was speaking and everything. When I hung up, I went back to reading his wall. "Just heard that Gus Waters died after a lengthy battle with cancer. Rest in peace, buddy." I knew these people were genuinely sad, and that I wasn't really mad at them. I was mad at the universe. Even so, it infuriated me. You get all these friends just when you don't need friends anymore. I wrote a reply to his comment. "We live in a universe devoted to the creation and eradication of awareness. Augustus Waters did not die after a lengthy battle with cancer. He died after a lengthy battle with human consciousness, a victim, as you will be, of the universe's need to make and unmake all that is possible." I posted it and waited for someone to reply, refreshing over and over again. Nothing. My comment got lost in the blizzard of new posts. Everyone was going to miss him so much. Everyone was praying for his family.
I remembered Van Houten's letter. Writing does not resurrect. It buries. After a while, I went out into the living room to sit with my parents and watch TV. I couldn't tell you what the show was, but at some point, my mom said, "Hazel, what can we do for you?" And I just shook my head. I started crying again. "What can we do?" Mom asked again. I shrugged. But she kept asking, as if there were something she could do. Until finally I just kind of crawled across the couch into her lap, and my dad came over and held my legs really tight. And I wrapped my arms all the way around my mom's middle, and they held on to me for hours while the tide rolled in.
Chapter 22. When we first got there, I sat in the back of the visitation room, a little room of exposed stone walls off to the side of the sanctuary in the literal heart of Jesus Church. There were maybe 80 chairs set up in the room, and it was 2/3 full but felt 1/3 empty. For a while, I just watched people walk up to the coffin, which was on some kind of cart covered in a purple tablecloth. All these people I'd never seen before would kneel down next to him or stand over him and look at him for a while, maybe crying, maybe saying something, and then all of them would touch the coffin instead of touching him, because no one wants to touch the dead. Gus's mom and dad were standing next to the coffin, hugging everybody as they passed by. But when they noticed me, they smiled and shuffled over. I got up and hugged first his dad and then his mom, who held on to me too tight, like Gus used to, squeezing my shoulder blades. They both looked so old, their eye sockets hollowed, the skin sagging from their exhausted faces. They had reached the end of a hurdling sprint, too.
"He loved you so much," Gus's mom said. "He really did. It wasn't puppy love or anything," she added, as if I didn't know that.
"He loved you so much, too," I said quietly. It's hard to explain, but talking to them felt like stabbing and being stabbed.
"I'm sorry," I said.
And then his parents were talking to my parents, the conversation all nodding and tight lips. I looked up at the casket and saw it unattended, so I decided to walk up there. I pulled the oxygen tube from my nostrils and raised the tube up over my head, handing it to Dad. I wanted it to be just me and just him. I grabbed my little clutch and walked up the makeshift aisle between the rows of chairs. The walk felt long, but I kept telling my lungs to shut up, that they were strong, that they could do this. I could see him as I approached. His hair was parted neatly on the left side in a way that he would have found absolutely horrifying, and his face was plasticized. But he was still Gus, my lanky, beautiful Gus. I wanted to wear the little black dress I'd bought for my 15th birthday party, my death dress, but I didn't fit into it anymore, so I wore a plain black dress, knee length. Augustus wore the same thin lapelled suit he'd worn to Orange. As I knelt, I realized they'd closed his eyes. Of course they had. And that I would never again see his blue eyes.
"I love you, present tense," I whispered,
and then put my hand on the middle of his chest and said,
"It's okay, Gus. It's okay. It is. It's okay. You hear me?"
I had and have absolutely no confidence that he could hear me. I leaned forward and kissed his cheek.
"Okay,"
I said.
"Okay."
I suddenly felt conscious that there were all these people watching us. That the last time so many people saw us kiss, we were in the Anne Frank house. But there was, properly speaking, no us left to watch. Only a me. I snapped open the clutch, reached in, and pulled out a hard pack of Camel Lights. In a quick motion I hoped no one behind would notice, I snuck them into the space between his side and the coffin's plush silver lining.
You can light these, I whispered to him. I won't mind.
While I was talking to him, Mom and Dad had